Gardaí are investigating the Kerry babies case, and they've now turned their attention to the UK and the hope that the DNA database there could unlock the 33-year-old mystery behind the murder of baby John. Ralph Regal is the Southern correspondent with the Irish Independent, and he has the story. Ralph, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, this is a new line of inquiry in terms of going to the UK database. Do we know why?
I suppose it's inevitable, Pat, for a number of different reasons. Number one, the fact that the Irish database, DNA database, is less than 3 years old. It was only established about 2015, and there's only around 15,000 samples on file. So it's very small at the moment. It's getting bigger, but it's very small. Whereas in contrast, the UK DNA database is one of the world's greatest databases for genetic samples. It was founded almost, actually the bones of 20 years ago. It has 6 million samples on file. And it also has one of the greatest detection records in the world in terms of assigning individuals at crime scenes to identities. So it's hugely effective. It's very advanced in terms of its search engines, how it can be cross-referenced and analysed. And I suppose the critical thing is that there's such movement between Ireland and the UK, particularly in terms of, say, Northern Ireland and England. And you see a lot of people back and forth, a lot of people who would have relatives over there. And that's the critical point. Searching a database like this, in a way, it's not that the guards are hoping to find a specific individual match. What they're hoping for is a pointer, because even if it's a distant relative, it's fifth or sixth or seventh cousin, it can give a pointer to the guards of where to focus their inquiry in terms of relatives of that individual who may have been in the Kerry area in the critical period of 1983-84.
So it's not that they're making some assumption that one of those involved in this killing would have left the jurisdiction and then come in contact in some way with the police forces in the UK. They're not making that assumption. They're taking a rather broader view.
It is, Pat, but there's also a number of theories being examined. I mean, certainly what the guards are saying is that they can't rule out the possibility that one or possibly both of baby John's parents may not be in Kerry anymore. So there is a possibility that one or both may now be overseas. But I think the critical thing is that searching databases like that in the UK, it's throwing the net to the widest possible degree, and it offers the opportunity, as I said, to try and, even if you don't get a direct match, to say, well, that is definitely the father or definitely the mother. If you get a relative, it allows the guards to focus their inquiry on a very specific area in terms of, well, look, we know the individual. We can look at the family. Were there any family members that were in Kerry in 83, 84? And it allows the inquiry to be focused very specifically. Now, of course, that's going on in tandem with local inquiries.
Yeah.
They're going back over various records. They're going back over various witness statements, whatever, to try and determine, you know, the identity of the mother. And they're also looking at individuals who may have been in Kerry in 83, 84 and left the area. They're looking over basically every possible strand of inquiry that can be done in the general Kerry area to try and assign an identity to the parents of this little baby.
What was the format of the meeting? A lot of focus, obviously, on Nigel and the controversy surrounding him, but there were other keynote speakers there, so... What went on?
Yeah, a number of speakers, Pat, from Eurosceptic backgrounds. You had Anthony Coughlin, formerly of Trinity College. He's very much one of the sort of more long-running figures in Euroscepticism in Ireland. You had Cormac Lucy, the economist and columnist, and Dr. Karen Devine of DCU, as well as John Waters. Now, the crowd is very energetic, and they're very behind some of the ideas, such as controls on immigration, the idea that taking back our fisheries would be of a huge financial benefit to Ireland, and generally around those ideas of sovereignty and addressing a democracy deficit in Europe. Now, some of the rhetoric and turns of phrase in the meeting were quite noteworthy just because they were quite unusual. We don't really hear them that often in an Irish political context. We had the idea of treason was used a lot in the United Kingdom in the Brexit debate, but we had Cormac Lucy referring to pro-EU people who he said would rather give control to those outside as Quislings, which of course derives from a Nazi collaborator in
Quislings.
Germany. Quislings, yeah. So
that's very... Dramatic.
Well, I've approached him as opposed to whether he felt that it was appropriate in the context, but haven't heard back from him in that regard. John Waters in particular, he built his speech around the idea that the European Union, that what's been happening with that has been a metastatic cancer that had torn away at the three pillars of society as he saw it, in family, in church and in nation. And we have some of that speech now, but opinion polls show that, and this is the big question around the idea of our exit, that maybe 80 to 90% of the public say that Irish EU membership is a good thing. So I also wanted to know if the attendees felt it was a realistic goal.
Immigrant populations attracted by prosperity and modernity converge for economic reasons only. They have no affinity or affection or allegiance to the country they end up in. Yes, freedom is there, but our leadership stands between us and freedom. We have to remove them. And in order to remove them, we need to have a conversation, which means we have to remove the media because they will not permit us to have a conversation.
Well, but there's other Irish people who agree with me that the EU is going to basically destroy Ireland. It's going to swallow it up and spit it out when there's nothing left.
It'll be an uphill struggle. I'm a retired civil servant who had a lot to do with Brussels and the Commission. I think the institutions are probably beyond the point of being reformable. So it's this or nothing.
John Waters' bit about removing the media.
That's kind of interesting. It's a common theme that you would have had, especially in the Brexit debate as well. Obviously, there were some, in some speeches and some talking to some members of the audience as well, they felt that the media hadn't covered this at all, despite the fact that, you know, a lot of us in the media were there covering the event, and I'm not sure how a lot of people would have heard about it beforehand otherwise. But it is, those were two excerpts from John Waters' speech there. But yeah, the idea of, you know, addressing the media or getting the media out of the way of the conversation and going online and trying to circumnavigate it in a way, that was one of the most popular ideas. It's something that got the crowd amongst the most energised.
Some of the comments coming in. I live in the west of Ireland. I've seen infrastructure and living standards improve immeasurably since joining the EU. People are gullible. Some blame the EU for everything. If we ever leave the EU, then we deserve everything we get. And by the way, Euro bureaucrats are no different from Irish ones. Why do people harp on and on about them? That's from Kevin. I would be in favour of the EU if it ever did come to a vote, but I fully agree with concerns over central governing and sovereign nations. For me, the EU needs to look at why it was founded. It was based on trade, and that's true. It was the EEC originally, the European Economic Community, and then it became the EC, and then finally the EU. Another one, the EU has done nothing for Ireland. It's just part of the new world order.
Interesting. But no, there is, and this is something I think from having gone to the meeting that, you know, there does need to be a conversation about the idea of EU membership. And you hear things like PESCO come out a lot and people will get very emotional about that because it is an emotional issue. It addresses things like Ireland's neutrality and its place in a militarised Europe, if you want to take it at that phrase. But there's never been really any explanation of why things are beneficial, and because that conversation just simply doesn't happen. You'll put people in different boxes, whether they're, you know, barmy Brussels bureaucrats or are they, you know,
There's an element of eating bread soon forgotten. You know, you look at the infrastructure that has been built, the motorways and so on, with the help of the EU. You look at the farm payments and so on and how that has kept people on the land. But that's kind of eating bread. And it's only when it is taken away, which it will be in Northern Ireland and in Britain, the rest of Britain, when there will be no agricultural payments, they will have to be replaced by Westminster if it's to continue. So anyway, we shall see how all of that pans out. In terms of Friday's cross-examination, what did we learn?
Yeah, so Friday was the second day of Brendan Kelly's cross-examination of the complainant. He is the defence barrister acting for Paddy Jackson, who is accused of raping the woman at his house in June 2016. He also denies a charge of sexual assault. Now, I think the last time we spoke, I brought you through the recording of the first ABE interview that was played for the jury. ABE standing for Achieving Best Evidence. This is an interview conducted by a specially trained officer with the PSNI. This was the second interview then that was played on Friday. It took place on July 21st. That was almost a month after the alleged rapes took place. And the woman said she was asked if she remembered anything else, like conversations that took place at the party, anything else that would help the police with their investigation. And she said she did remember some more details in the month before she had made that first statement to the police. She said she remembered getting in a taxi outside the nightclub with two other girls on June 27th, 2016. Paddy Jackson was also in their company. A taxi was parked outside, we heard. It was booked for another fare, but she got into the taxi with two other girls, and Paddy Jackson stuck his head into the driver's window, told the driver who he was, and the driver then took them back to the party. She said that there was a discussion between herself and Paddy Jackson in the taxi on the way back, that she had told him that he probably wouldn't remember, but that they had actually met in a bar that she was working in sometime before that night. She was asked about the party. She said she remembered dancing a bit at it with Rory Harrison. He is one of the four accused. He is facing charges of perverting the course of justice and withholding information from the police. She said she didn't really chat much to the others at the party, but took a dislike to Blaine McElroy, who was facing one count of exposure. And she said in this police interview that when she took this dislike to him, he hadn't really done anything at that point, but that it was more of a gut feeling that she formed this opinion with. She said he was sitting on the sofa at one point with two girls on his lap, and he was taking photographs. And she was also asked about any interactions that she had with Stuart Olding, Paddy Jackson's Ulster and Ireland teammate, who is facing a rape charge as well and also denies it. And she said that she remembered bumping into him at one point in the kitchen, but she said she didn't speak to him at all. She was also asked then about the witness, and we spoke about this on Friday, because in her first statement with police, she failed to mention that a woman had walked in at one point. She described it as being secondary. She didn't think it was as important as the rape itself and the effect it had on her. So she went into a bit more detail about her recollection of this woman walking in. She said she just remembers turning around when the door opened. She saw a girl standing there, but she turned around immediately because people downstairs at the party, and this is alleged to have happened in Paddy Jackson's upstairs bedroom, and she said the people downstairs throughout the party had been uploading photographs and videos onto their Snapchat stories, and she was worried that she was going to be filmed. So she said she turned around and didn't get a good look at the woman. But she said that was during the interview, she said that was the key bit that she wanted to say following her first interview with police.
Now, there was also a video of Ollie's nightclub.
That's right. So Ollie's nightclub is a nightclub in the basement of the Merchant Hotel in Belfast City, and that's where she was the night before the alleged rape. And we were shown video footage from the VIP section of the nightclub. It was towards the end of the night, and the footage clearly showed Paddy Jackson and Blaine McElroy, two of the accused, in that section, as well as a number of Northern Ireland footballers who had returned from the Euros a few days before and hadn't been knocked out by Wales on the previous Friday evening. This was a Monday evening. Will Grigg and Kyle Lafferty were pointed out in the footage, two Northern Ireland footballers. And while she said that she didn't know who either of those were under cross-examination on Friday, she said she didn't know the men, but she did recognise Will Grigg's name from the song Will Grigg's on Fire. And at one point on the footage, Jackson's barrister said she seems to place her hand on Mr. Lafferty's knee. Now, she said that she didn't remember doing that, but she did accept that she was a bit drunk and appeared to be stumbling around in the footage that was shown to her.
I think it's dysfunctional. The people on the front line, the doctors, the nurses, are doing a wonderful job under the most difficult circumstances. But the whole system is badly organised from the top down. So government and the HSE are seriously behind the ball.
If you're not ill before you go in, by the time you've been in hospital, chances are he will have got the MRI bug or God knows what else.
I would feel at this stage there's far too many top management. They don't talk enough to the people on the floor, the ground floor. You know, the people, the nurses who meet people who are there every day, they don't talk enough to them. And if they're certainly listening to them, they're not listening to them properly. I do have private medical health insurance. In relation to being treated differently, no, because when you're greeted, if you have to go in for a day procedure, they're going to ask you, do you have private insurance? If you say yes you do, then you're going to be given the option. If you have a private room, 9 times out of 10 there isn't a private room available, so you're going to be going in with there's no problem with that. It's the same, you're getting the same benefifts.
So it's just getting into the system.
It's getting into the system, and I think I know from a family member who's recently just recovering from cancer, I think it's getting, once you're in the system is incredible, and it just it moves along so quickly. Get a good leader in there, you know, get somebody in. I think we just need to break it down. It's just gone so big, and it's become so administration and top heavy. You know, it's just, they've forgotten about the grassroots.
Disorganised.
You felt it was disorganised?
Yeah, absolutely disorganised. My wife was pregnant, had pains, went to
a maternity hospital
over here, She was checked. She was just released to go get some extra tests at one of the at another hospital.
Another clinic,
yeah. She got there. The doctor checked her over. He was afraid that it might be an ectopic pregnancy. He asked her, how did she get here? And he was totally surprised that the maternity hospital just had released her to get a taxi or bus, find a way to the doctor's office, where the doctor then had put in an ambulance to bring her back to the maternity hospital.
So you weren't impressed?
No, to say the least, no.
How does the Irish health service compare to South Africa?
Well, the public health service would possibly be better here in Ireland, but the private health service wouldn't. There with the private health service, the hospitals look like hotels. It's a proper private healthcare, where yeah, it's just a mix and match of public and private, and it's just messed up.
So you found the service in hospital good?
Yes, yeah. It's getting into it and getting appointments and stuff like that is a different kind.
So once you're registered, once you're in the door?
Once you're in, yes, I'm very happy with it too.
Now, we want to get some responses, Anthony, to what Paul was saying about, you know, using the talents that are available more effectively.
I think we have to use the skills of all our staff to the outer limit. And that does mean changing roles.
Okay, now you were away for, what, a decade. You come back here and you observed, as you did during the commercial break, how little things had changed.
Very little has changed since I was a medical student in the mid-80s. And that's disturbing, in fact.
So what needs to change?
We need to have a very serious think about what the service is for. We need to let managers manage the service. We need to build a culture of management and accountability, because we don't. We have a serious problem with accountability.
But you know, the criticism of the bean counters looking for performance indexes or indices and saying, well, you discharge people after 4 days, whereas Austin discharged people after 2 days. Good boy, Austin.
We have to.
you want to get away from that?
We have to be smarter than that. I mean, that's dead easy to do. We could copy all the mistakes the NHS has made in that area. We shouldn't. We should learn from what they've done. We should learn to have a culture where we trust people to operate effectively, but we hold them to account if they don't. So we let professionals be professionals. Mm. But if they don't come up to scratch, if they misbehave, we manage them effectively.
Now, here's a question which all of you, I'm sure, would have a view on. A few years back, they changed nurse training from nursing school and on the ward training into university-based training with some time spent on the wards in the latter stages. The idea of that was to upskill nursing staff to a very high level because they're now coming out with a university degree. Has the way we use nurses changed since that system changed?
I don't think it's changed. I mean, I think that was an inevitable requirement of modern education.
But then we use them the same way.
Well, what happens is student nurses don't have the role they used to have in providing care. They come to the hospital primarily to learn, and they have their own tutors, and they do some of the tasks which would be otherwise done by the nurses, but not in an efficient way which makes a material difference. Whereas in the old days, the student nurse was an abused member of the staff who just packed in the night stuff, etc.
Yeah.
And that's wonderful that that's gone. But I think one of the interesting things to focus on is I think we could all take examples around the world of best practice. Unfortunately, and I think maybe Anthony's touched on this, we seem to base everything we do on the British National Health Service, which, as I pointed out, isn't rating quite as well as our health service internationally. I mean, there are so many examples around Europe. For example, we at the moment have something like 500,000 people awaiting outpatient appointments. That's been dealt with in Denmark. And it's been dealt with by getting doctors to use other forms of communication with people, emails, telephone calls, to triage people to see if they really need to come to the hospital or they need. And a lot of the follow-up appointments that go on in our hospitals and that pack out our outpatients, they can be dealt with by email. They could be dealt with by phone call, ringing you up and saying, we have the results of your histology, it's fine, you don't need to come to the hospital. I'd rather see somebody who's waiting to see me for the last year.
But is there an element that comes from, if you like, the private practice model? You come back in and your knee is fine, thank you very much, that'll be 120 guineas in the old days.
Well, I don't
you know. Is that?
I don't know if it's fair to say. I mean, private practice, let's just analyse this because it's been discussed. In the Irish Health Service, 70% of the funding that we're so proud of comes from the public purse. The other 30% comes from private practice. We have a unique situation. I mean, I worked in the States where Blue Cross Blue Shield is generally used as an incentive to join a work organisation, and it's generally for the very hoi polloi in society. We have a 50% of our people have health insurance. It's an it's a direct taxation which adds to the health service. Like, think about this. If we didn't have that 30% contribution, if tomorrow we went to a totally socialised model, we wouldn't have half the health service we have at the present time.